This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 43 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max.
David, hi. We've got an interesting lineup of topics this episode. It's kind of good uses for UAVs and a few bad uses mixed in there.
Yeah, well, we've talked about good and bad, and now it seems like it's being pervasive throughout the UAV universe.
That's right, both sides.
So our topics tonight will be roll that beautiful drone footage, UAVs go industrial, industrious cartels go into the UAV drug smuggling business, a woman many of us could drone on and on and her career in manufacturing UAVs, and of course our video of the week and listener mail. Our first news story is from flyingmag.com. FAA may exempt film industry UAV rules. So it looks like the FAA is thinking, well, maybe those people in Southern California who make movies, they're allowed to fly UAVs, huh, Max?
The FAA says that they're considering granting 7 specific professional aerial cinematography companies an exemption that allows them to make commercial use of UAVs in making films and videos and so forth. It's not a blanket exemption for the whole industry. It's for 7 specific companies. And this comes in part from a petition that the Motion Picture Association of America filed on behalf of the 7 companies.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that the MPAA has more power than the rest of us. You know, yeah. It's... I guess multi-million dollar companies in Southern California that make movies seem to have more power than the rest of us who are doing cinematography for things like real estate or landscapes or, you know.
Yeah, agriculture, sure.
Agriculture, yeah, it is kind of, this is with all of the growth in things in like real estate and agriculture.
Why
the
movies,
the FAA's
right?
Picking, well, yeah, why movies, you know, now. Now, mind you, if they start using it on Star Trek Episode 7, I might not be have a problem. But it's between you and me, it's and our, I guess, and the hundreds of listeners we have now. It just seems odd that this is the first ones to that they've decided to carve an exemption out of.
Well, you know, I think that they're organized and that can be a large part of it. And it's kind of a targeted approach here. I think it's really interesting to look at what the FAA has said about this in their press release, and also to look at the actual petitions from the 7 companies. But what the FAA has said in their press release on this topic is that to receive the exemptions, the firms must show that their UAS operations will not adversely affect safety, or provide at least an equal level of safety to the rules from which they seek an exemption. They would also need to show why granting the exemption would be in the public interest. And that's from the FAA press release. There's more. They say that the firms are asking the agency to grant exemptions from regulations that address general flight rules, pilot certificate requirements, manuals, maintenance, and equipment mandates. They are also asking for relief from airworthiness certification requirements as allowed under Section 333. Under that section of the law, certain airworthiness requirements can be waived to let specific UAS fly safely in narrowly defined, controlled, low-risk situations. I think it's interesting. These 7 companies, these aren't just guys with home-built quadcopters in their basements. These are real professional companies. Just... listen to the lineup. You may know some of them. Aerial Mob, Astrius Aerial, Flying Cam Inc., Heli Video Productions, Pictor Vision Inc., Vortex Aerial, and my favorite one, David, Snap Roll Media. It's quite a collection. It's not the entire industry. It's only those seven firms. The actual petitions to receive exemptions at the regulations.gov site. We'll put the links to all seven of those in the show notes, because I think reading them kind of gives you an idea of the scope and what's required here to get an exemption. I'm looking at the one from Snap Roll Media. It says in the petition to the FAA, the requested exemption would permit the operation of small, unmanned, and relatively inexpensive SUAS under controlled conditions in airspace that is 1. Limited, 2. Predetermined, 3. Controlled as to access, and 4. Would provide safety enhancements to the already safe operations in the film and television industry presently using conventional aircraft. I think it's worth taking a look at the limitations and conditions that each of these seven companies have. And, you know, this will sound kind of familiar, a lot of these, but again, it really gives you an idea of the sort of the detail here. It says the SUAS will weigh less than 55 pounds. Flights will be operated within line of sight of a pilot and or observer. Maximum total flight time, 30 minutes. Flights terminated at 25% battery power reserve. Flights will be operated at an altitude of no more than 400 feet AGL. Minimum crew for each operation will consist of the SUAS pilot, the visual observer, and the camera operator. Now, listen to this one. The SUAS pilot will be an FAA-licensed airman with at least a private pilot certificate and third-class medical. And it goes on and on. There are at least 18 limitations and conditions that all read like that. It's not small potatoes. This is not a process that's, you know, kind of applicable to the general enthusiast. It kind of points to the degree to which you have to provide these specific bits of information and conditions that you're going to operate under in order to even approach the FAA to say, can I fly my, you know, my UAV in a commercial situation? Very interesting. So we'll put a lot of links to these in the show notes, and I think it's worth taking a look at.
And the UAV pilot is actually a pilot. That's something we've heard a little bit of from Great Britain and Australia. Mm. And one of the things that I was thinking about is, yeah, they're using these for commercial purposes, but everybody knows that a film set is a closed environment.
Right.
If they're going to be doing filming, it's going to be over a film, either a set or a location. And that's usually fairly locked down. There's very little general public in the area. And so it does sort of make sense that the FAA is saying, okay, well, this sort of environment is conducive because we have a very controlled environment. There's minimal amount of variables, whereas when you're flying in the general public, the variables grow exponentially. So
right.
This does make sense as a stepping stone. I know that there's a lot of people out there, including some of my friends, who look at this and go, well, you know what? I'm doing the same thing under the same control circumstances, but I'm filming a house. Why can't I do it? We're going to have to monitor it. It might set standards. Ooh, what a concept for the FAA that, you know, okay, here are real-time test cases, you know, in real environments. And yeah, these are standards that work. So I'm going to say this and I can't believe it, but I'm kind of impressed the FAA is taking these steps, you know, instead of being so entranced in their usual no commercial, no commercial, no commercial. So it might be a glimmer of hope.
Yeah, and I think this industry, this film industry, has done their homework. I think the law firm representing them is Cooley on this, and someone has definitely done a lot of good homework in order to capture in these petitions all the criteria that, you know, they believe will be required for the FAA to grant them the exemption. And sort of my final comment is that, you know, if you have a company, if you have a business that would like to receive an exemption from the FAA so you can begin operations, reading these documents, that will tell you, at least at this point in time, what's required, what you're going to have to do or what you would have to do in order for the FAA to grant you a waiver and allow you to commence commercial operations.
So dot your I's and cross your T's.
Exactly.
But with every positive, there's a negative. Our next story is from BostonMagazine.com. Can drone use cut helicopter filming business? If or when commercial air or video operations from small UASs take place, what will be the impact on traditional helicopter companies? Jeff Dietz, a line pilot and flight instructor from the North Andover Flight Academy in Massachusetts, says, quote, it absolutely will impact the industry. Jobs that used to be only done by helicopters can now be done by these drones. Any way you look at it, there's a percentage that's going to be carved out by the niche market for these types of drones. So we all know the drones are cheaper, faster, better.
Not in all situations, but certainly in a lot of situations that you'd otherwise would think about employing a manned helicopter.
And, I mean, helicopters are dangerous. I mean, back in the days of Airwolf, they had several camera copters and, you know, Airwolf being the television show from the mid-80s about, and they lost both video helicopters and stuff just because the nature of the business. A helicopter is an intrinsically, I don't know, I don't want to say unsafe because we're going to get a lot of our helicopter pilots against us, but
it's a complicated way to fly.
It is a complicated way to fly. Beating the ground into submission is definitely different than an airplane. But even then, the UAVs might take over conventional aircraft used for photography also. So it's interesting that motion picture industry is trying to reduce costs and up safety, maybe.
And get the shots that they couldn't always get with a traditional helicopter. But, you know, the way I look at this is that UAVs, this is a disruptive technology, right? That's a term that you will hear when sort of the game changes significantly. It affects the legacy business operations in a way that's not always the greatest. So, yeah, could drone use cut into the helicopter filming business? I think absolutely. Not only could it, but it will. And if your business is the manned helicopter filming business, I think you've got to take a look at what you're doing, how you're doing it, what's your market, how they're going to respond, and sort of act accordingly. Because, yeah, I think you could ultimately see a big chunk of your business taken away by drones.
One of my favorite stories, one of my least favorite musicals of all time, is The Sound of Music.
Oh, the classic.
When we got the 50th anniversary edition or whatever, they talked about filming that beloved scene where she's on top of the hill that was filmed by a helicopter. Ironically, that footage was filmed multiple times because the downwash from the helicopter filming kept pushing Julie in her beloved white dress down the hill, forming all sorts of grass stains and such. And that's clearly a classic cinematic helicopter footage. They could have got it done in one or two takes with a drone.
Sure.
Clearly, there's some advantages there, but I think we better move on. We're getting bogged down by film.
Yeah, well, we got another link from Peter. This is from CBC in Canada. Drones go commercial, take on tasks from industry to farming. Yeah, I mean, this is a piece that kind of talks about the use of unmanned aerial vehicles in Canada and that it's kind of one of the places to be these days. The article mentions Canada's Aireon Labs, which has the Skyranger and the Scout quadcopters. And they talk about applications like police accident investigations and power line inspections and the ability of these kinds of unmanned vehicles to provide great services and, you know, in those applications. The Aireon president said, quote, one of our customers from the UK had to turn the power lines back on and they had to check an insulator on the other side of a river. They would have had to find some way across the river, get a boat, get across, climb up, but instead they just flew a drone up there. Job done. They also mentioned some of the advantages that kind of exist in Canada.
Military markets are dominated by companies in the U.S., but they have export control regulations that Canada doesn't have. Now, we've talked about this a lot, that this has been a gripe by a lot of our U.S. manufacturers because things like Airbus military and other nations like Israel do not have the export regulations that the United States have. Canada doesn't have regulatory requirements that are restrictive like the FAA. Drink. Canada's companies can focus on commercial applications. Well, the U.S. can focus on commercial applications all they want, but right now they can't move the products to market. Canada can. And Canada, believe it or not, folks, even though they're way up north, is a huge agricultural nation, and they can continue developing their agriculture and precision agriculture with UAVs. So to paraphrase Top Gun, a drone-friendly environment.
It is. Now, let me ask you a question, David, on that topic. Do you think that in that kind of a drone-friendly environment like exists in Canada and some other places as well, do you think that will give them a competitive advantage, sort of a jump start into this industry as the rest of the world, like the U.S., tries to catch up? Do you think it's an advantage to them?
Well, anytime you set up barriers for introduction of products or whatever, or hurdles to overcome, yeah. Right now, even though the U.S. is one of the top three countries in producing UAVs and UASs, they really have barriers into markets, whereas places like Canada and Israel don't have those barriers. So, well, Israel being probably number one ahead as far as drone production, as far ahead of the United States, they can sell things to third countries. And as much as testing in a environment is good, the lessons learned from real time and real life productivity and missions far exceed however clean the testing environment you're working in. And we have seven test sites in the United States, and they're all scheduled to do different things, but there's nothing like putting the drone out in the real world and learning what it was, because stuff will come up in the real world that won't come up in sanitized testing environments. So I think UAV-friendly countries like Canada will catch up and maybe even possibly surpass the United States, and Israel's well on its way, and other nations are going to learn from the real-world experiences. The problem is sometimes those real-world experiences have consequences. You know, it might be Canada that has the first UAV fly into it, intake of an airliner, and, I mean, those are the kind of give and takes you got.
Well, speaking about putting UAVs into the real world, we got an article from Mark that's pretty interesting concerning what some of the bad guys might be up to.
Yeah, if we thought drug smuggling submarines were a unique technology, these two or three man subs that they're using to smuggle drugs, well, people see opportunities. And in Mexico, they're working on building UAVs that could smuggle drugs across the border to the United States. And there's no loss of life with a UAV, you know, unless it gets crashed into a building or something. But our border on Mexico and Texas is pretty wide open, and you can carry a lot of payload with a DJI Phantom or larger.
Well, you know, there's a drone lawyer, John Davison, and he has a blog. Actually, it's a fairly interesting blog. It's titled Law of Drones, UASs, UAVs, and SUASs. And we'll put a link in the show notes, but that's MissouriDroneLaw.blogspot.com. Davidson writes, before long, ambitious cartel members will begin to fly unmanned drone aircraft from Mexico into the U.S. packed with high-value narcotics. And it's interesting, this article, in describing how the cartels are setting up drone assembly plants, it makes the comment that these are being made by aircraft factory workers who are moonlighting for the cartels. There's a claim anyway that there's a drone assembly line located in Mexico City, which happens to be near the Bombardier factory. Oh boy, I hate to think that the employees of the legitimate aviation industry are moonlighting for the cartels to help build drug-carrying drones. Boy, what a terrible thing.
But it does explain a lot of issues with the C-Series, doesn't
no,
it?
No, don't go there. don't go there.
Unfortunately, we've talked about this. You know, you use the term And my mind just escaped me. What was the term you used? Disruptive technology. Well, you know, the bad guys are just as sharp as the good guys sometimes. And, the mini subs that they've been using was a disruptive technology. The navies were shocked that these people were getting in subs and smuggling drugs in small designer submarines. Well, the cartels can see what's a good way to do it. And there's low cost, high efficiency. And when you're smuggling drugs across the border using first person view, you're not actually crossing the border, are you? The UAV is.
Yeah.
What I was thinking about when reading this article was I have pictures of Border and Custom Patrol Reapers, or Predator 2s, as they like to call them, with air-to-air missiles. So we have drone warfare over the southern states where we have drones shooting down other drones because they're carrying drugs. And, you know, the good guys are going to find ways to use the technology just like the bad guys.
Sure.
Or vice versa. But let's talk about bombshells.
I love this story. This came from listener Zhao. Is that how you pronounce his name, do you think?
Zhao, if we've got it wrong, we're sorry. My wife happens to be a fan of this individual big time, and when I sent her this article, she just sort of went, wow. This is a history article back to World War II, and it was from the New York Times. World War II drone program. A young woman by the name of Norma Jean worked in the radio plane factory in Southern California, building small radio-controlled aircraft that they called them at the time that were going to be used as gunnery targets for Navy pilots and Army Air Corps pilots.
What happened is, as it turned out, that a certain captain ordered a photographer to take some pictures of women who were involved in war production. You remember Rosie the Riveter? Well, he was looking for more of those kinds of shots. And so this photographer took a picture of Norma Jean holding a radio plane propeller and in sort of, you know, smiling and looking beautiful and all. And it's interesting who that turned out to be.
Yeah, anybody who knows the Elton John song Goodbye Norma Jean knows who that really is about. And that's Marilyn Monroe.
That's right. At age 18,
she was building UAVs. Max, nothing gets better than that, to know that, you know, one of the most gorgeous women of all times was so ahead of her time building UAVs.
Absolutely. And then the other part of the story that makes it really nice is who the captain was who had the photographer go out and shoot the women.
Yeah, this second-rate actor enlisted, and a lot of the actors were enlisted in the military, and in fact, this was a captain, in charge of doing publicity and PR films and propaganda films. And this actor eventually went on to become governor of California. No, folks, Arnold isn't old enough for that. This gentleman also then went on to become the president of the United States, and that is
Ronald Reagan. So, interesting piece of history, Marilyn Monroe and Ronald Reagan coming together in the same story.
And if you think about it, Marilyn was involved with another president of the United States whose brother, who was supposed to be the president of the United States, died in a UAV accident also.
Hmm.
And that would have been Joseph Kennedy, was the older brother of John F. Kennedy. So Marilyn is intertwined a lot with UAVs and drone technology, even back in, but, you know, let's just take a minute, take deep breaths and think about how beautiful that woman was. And what a loss.
All right, David. Okay. All right. Hey, let's move on to the video of the week. This came in from Kevin. And what it is it's about Coca-Cola delivering cans of Coke to construction workers in Singapore.
The world to see.
That's right.
In perfect harmony.
The interesting thing to
fly the world the Coke with a UAV today. That's the real thing.
You know, the nice thing about this is that, I mean, it's not so much about the actual video or the notion of, you know, delivering sodas to these guys. It's interesting that UAVs have kind of come into the mainstream to the point where a company like Coca-Cola is using them as part of a marketing campaign or advertising campaign. I don't think you have to go back very far to when you're at a time where that wouldn't have even been considered. And, you know, here we have Coke in Singapore doing this. So thanks to Kevin for passing that along. Put a link to that in the show notes.
And Max, we got less than 2 weeks.
That's right.
Become a pilot day at the Smithsonian Institution at the Udvar-Hazy Center. Max and I have been going now. This will be our fourth year. Hard to believe. And we record our other podcast, Airplane Geeks, there. But we would love to have some of our UAV Digest listeners show up, because we hopefully will do at least one or two segments for the show on Pilot Day. But Pilot Day is the Smithsonian opens up its gates to the Dulles Airport, and they taxi in all sorts of aircraft. And this year, the biggest aircraft will be a 777 from United. But people fly their airplanes in so they can share the joy of aviation. And it's time for Max and I and our co-host Rob and other friends to get together, and it's our reunion, our yearly reunion. The other part of it is Saturday night around 7:30, there's a Red Robin in just south of the museum where we have, I don't know, we host an open house or a social thing where we all have dinner together and we have a couple of beers, and we invite our listeners to come out and spend some time with us. And you guys listen to us every week. It's one of those ways we can give back and say thank you and put faces to all the names, because we've got really good listeners on Airplane Geeks and, dare I say it, better listeners on UAV Digest. You guys are great. And we would love to just meet you, shake your hands, talk to you, and at least let us say thank you for all of the time that you give us.
This is a great event. It's a family kind of event. You know, bring your spouse, bring your kids. There's a ton of things to do and see in and around the museum on this day. And again, it's June 14th. If you want to learn more, you can visit the Smithsonian's website, which is becomeapilot.si.edu. So check that out, and we'll hope to see you there.
All right. We got one feedback that was really interesting, and it was from Paul, who's an assistant fire chief in Texas. And he writes, "Gentlemen, listen to the show regularly. It is my best source of news and information from the UAV industry." Well, thank you for that. "Really interested in the use of unmanned systems in public safety. As a 20-plus year veteran of the fire service and a self-proclaimed tech geek, I'm trying to get more awareness out there for the search, rescue, and fire protection implications for unmanned systems." We've tried. We've talked about it a lot, and we've talked about the lawsuit in Texas now about the FAA prohibiting. But he's got a point. UAVs are conducive to search and rescue, and if there's anybody out there who's knows that they're getting into police or fire, maybe give us a shout out and tell us what you're doing and what you're using and what you're learning.
Yeah, Paul makes some interesting comments. He says, "I think too much emphasis is placed on the First Amendment implications of law enforcement, and it is restricting the good work that could be taking place in the fire service." He says he's been a member of AUVSI for the past 2 years in an effort to talk more about this, and while they are trying to make more of an effort, it is a slow pace. And he goes on and says his department is interested in using the technology. However, the public reaction to UAV usage isn't worth being on the cutting edge of using it. So I've taken to an individual effort to convince my brethren in the fire service to look much harder and become an advocate for its use. I hope you may be interested in putting some emphasis on one of your episodes and talking more specifically about this aspect of the industry." So there's a whole series of good points in there. On the First Amendment issue, I think was referring to is, you know, people have privacy concerns and are sometimes a little apprehensive about, well, the government or the police or the fire service or whoever using UAVs and thinking that, you know, their privacy may be in danger as a result. And I think what Paul is saying in part is that, yeah, but we could be doing so much more great stuff if, you know, if we had the ability to use these devices. So, you know, it's more than just the FAA, you know, not moving fast enough in the United States. There's also this perception issue on the part of the general population. And, you know, it's good to focus on the FAA, but I think we also need to consider, how do we change people's minds about what drones are all about? And then again, I guess that's part of why David and I are kind of doing what we're doing here.
Converting dronophobes, one person at a time.
Yeah. So thanks, Paul. Really appreciate it. Great letter.
And advocacy is sort of one of the things that, like you said, that we strive for. One of the reasons why I wanted to do this and roped you into it was I wanted to put a positive spin. I mean, we've come a long way in 43 weeks, you know. Now when people post pictures of drones in radio and mass media, they post DJI Phantoms. Now, mind you, there are other aircraft out there besides DJI Phantoms, but at least they're not showing local man flies drone and it's a picture of a Reaper firing a Hellfire at somebody.
Right.
So we appreciate the feedback and we really look forward to keeping going because we like talking about this subject and we like putting positive spins on it.
All right, David, with that, I think we'll say that you've been listening to episode 43 of the UAV Digest. You can find us at theuavdigest.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter, which hasn't started yet, but you can still sign up. Also, you can find show notes for this episode at theuavdigest.com/43 for episode 43.
You can join our conversation on Facebook, which is facebook.com/theuavdigest. Don't forget, we're on Twitter at uavdigest.com, which seems to be, we got a lot of Twitter followers. We seem to be making an impression somewhere. Feedback is always feedback@theuavdigest.com. And if you think it's more particular to one or the other, you could always do max@theuavdigest.com or david@theuavdigest.com. And if you listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher, leave us a comment or a feedback, and it's a way to get us out to everyone. Or you could do the old school advertising thing and buy something from our Cafe Press store, which is cafepress.com/theuavdigest. And of course, tell your friends.
That's right. Help spread the word. All right. So this is Max in Hartford.
And David in Philly.